Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. The fate of the Affordable Care Act lies in the Supreme Court's hands, and there's little, if anything, that President-elect Joe Biden can do about it. The justices are hearing oral arguments today in the case that seeks to overturn the landmark health reform law, sometimes called Obamacare, which now faces a 6-3 conservative-leaning majority. Here in California, we are currently in open enrollment through Covered California. That's the state's health insurance marketplace. Joining us now to help us navigate all of this and the future of the Affordable Care Act, or the ACA, is Cap Radio's healthcare reporter, Sammy Caiola. Sammy, always great to speak with you.
Good morning, Randall. Thanks for having me.
So, Sammy, help us understand what's happening at the Supreme Court right now as we speak.
This case is a huge deal. It's been in the pipeline for years. It started in 2017, 2018 with some Republican attorneys general who are making the legal argument that because the Trump administration zeroed out the penalty for not carrying insurance. So, right, there was a federal insurance requirement. And if you didn't carry insurance, you had to pay a fine. And then in, around 2017, the Trump administration says, we're going to make that fine $0. So on paper, the penalty still exists. It's just $0. And so, you know, the plaintiffs in this case are arguing that that makes the individual mandate unconstitutional because it's been zeroed out, and that therefore makes the entire Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. So here in California, Attorney General Javier Becerra has been very vocal about his disagreement with that legal argument. He says there is no legal argument that the rest of the ACA should stand, or at the very least, you should need to overturn the entire thing. So what they're discussing in court today, and will be probably for a while, I don't think we'll have a decision immediately on this, is whether the mandate is constitutional and whether that means you overturn the entire law, or if you start to sever out parts, and this is an argument around severability, whether the rest of the law can stand. And there are really key components here. We're talking about coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. We're talking about young adults up to age 26 being able to stay on their insurance plans. These are things we take for granted now, probably, but they were created by the Affordable Care Act, and it's made a huge impact in California's insurance rates.
Should the Supreme Court rule against the ACA, how would that affect Covered California for us?
Yeah, so Peter Lee can definitely speak to this a little bit later, but Covered California is one of the state-run healthcare exchanges created by the Affordable Care Act. So we're able to have Covered California because of the ACA. And we also get a lot of federal dollars, a lot of federal assistance. So if the ACA is overturned, California stands to lose about $27 billion in federal assistance that helps us run Covered California and helps support care for Medi-Cal patients. So that money is split between both Medi-Cal and Covered Cal. But it would be a huge deal. It would be very difficult for California to backfill that federal assistance and continue to run our marketplace the way we do, with premium subsidies for low and middle income consumers. And, you know, California has really embraced the Affordable Care Act more vigorously than probably any other state. We went from, you know, we decreased the uninsured rate in California from 6.5 million uninsured in 2012 to just 3.5 million in 2017. And I'm sure Peter has an even more updated number than that. But, you know, if it's fully dismantled, as far as how Covered California would still run, it would be tough. It would be very tough to backfill that assistance.
All right. Well, Sammy, let's bring in Peter Lee, Executive Director of Covered California. And Sammy, if you don't mind, I'm going to ask you to do something a little bit unusual here. And that is, if you could, I guess, in essence, co-host this segment with me, because just your knowledge in all of this is so incredible that I'm sure you will have questions that, you know, come to you that wouldn't come to me. But Peter, I would like to welcome you to Insight. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So, Peter, I assume you are watching closely what will happen at the U.S. Supreme Court today.
I am. I sort of wish I was listening by the moment, but I'm tracking it with people that are watching it. And actually, everything I'm hearing is actually good news about the sorts of questions being asked by conservative justices about what Sammy queued up really well. And if I could just spend a moment on this issue, take this for a moment?
Please.
The issue that Sammy raised is really at the core of this, which is the question of, quote, severability, which is the Republican attorneys general looked around and found a judge in a corner of Texas that if you filed your case in that district, there's only one judge who would hear it. This judge was a known outlier judge. It's called forum shopping. So they found a judge, they filed the case there, so he's the only judge they could possibly get. They weren't surprised they got a what many legal scholars would say is an absolutely cuckoo decision, because they picked a judge that might go that way. That said, the severability argument is one that would say to throw out the entire law is to say, if the mandate is unconstitutional, then that means also things like, as Sammy noted, protecting 130 million Americans who have pre-existing conditions from being denied coverage at the whim of insurance companies connected to a mandate. Medicare prescription drug benefits related to the mandate. Financial help through Medicaid related to the mandate. CDC funding for preventive services that address COVID related to the mandate. It's cuckoo. It's absolutely crazy. And the good news is, justices like Kavanaugh are asking questions right now saying, well, of course it's severable. Why wouldn't it be severable? So I'll tell you, I'm really confident, because we often talk about conservative justices and liberal justices. This isn't an issue of original interpretation, and this isn't an issue of Roe v. Wade that you got to find in the, this is basic interpreting the law. Congress passed a law that had a lot of features. If a feature isn't constitutional, the standard rule of legal interpretation is you let the other parts stand. It'd be legal gymnastics to say you've got to throw out the whole law. And also, and I just want to underscore one of the things that Sammy said, which is so right, is, but I want to put a twist on it. A lot of people talk about dollars. Yeah, it's $27 billion. But forget the dollars. It's people. Taking away that $27 billion would mean 5 million Californians would lose health insurance. 5 million Californians. And across the nation, about 25 million Americans losing coverage. And why the Attorney General Becerra has led the charge to tell the story to the justices is to take a stretch of a legal argument to throw 25 million people to be uninsured in the middle of a pandemic. Talk about kneecapping the validity of a Supreme Court that is some ways under question for how, is it political or not? I just can't imagine it.
Sammy, I'm going to let you jump in, Sammy.
Yeah, and Peter, I mean, I also want to talk a little bit about certain protections under the Affordable Care Act that would disappear. I know I've heard a lot from reproductive rights groups, reproductive health care could be on the line. There are special protections for contraceptive care and also for LGBTQ people who may struggle to get gender-based transition care. That's currently covered under ACA plans, and losing that kind of coverage could be really problematic. And Peter, we also know that low-income Californians, not just low-income Californians, especially Californians of color, their uninsured rates dropped dramatically due to the ACA, right? More so than white Californians. And so I think we just want to pay special attention to groups that would be uniquely impacted were this coverage to be reduced or eliminated.
Well, Sammy, if I could follow on that, because I think you raised a really important point. We are starting open enrollment, and I'm going to pivot to that in a moment, but I want to relate it to this question, is that forever there have been racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare. And I actually go back to 50 years ago when Medicare was implemented. One of the things it did is it changed hospitals that were up till then segregated and not allowing African-Americans in a lot of hospitals across America. Medicare said, sorry, you want Medicare dollars? You got to take everyone in. That was a core racial disparity that we all forget about. The same thing 8 years ago, the rate of uninsurance among African-Americans and Latinos was far higher and worse than it was for white Californians. COVID has put a spotlight on that issue today. The likelihood of dying of COVID is higher for African-Americans and for Latinos than it is for white Californians. And not as bad here as other parts of the nation. And what we have to be doing is looking at what does it mean to have a law that today is providing a huge benefit to millions of Americans. And in California, which Sammy noted, it's right, we've reduced the rate of uninsured more than any state in the entire nation. But still, here in California, there are 1.2 million Californians eligible for either Medi-Cal or Cover California, uninsured today, who haven't signed up. So we aren't done on a path to, you know, we're a state that believes in universal coverage, but we're out there pounding the pavement saying, boy, in a pandemic, sign up for coverage now. Now's not the time to worry about a Supreme Court. Whatever happens there, anyone that signs up today is guaranteed they're going to have that coverage through 2021. And I am very confident that the Supreme Court's going to go the right direction. But the last thing I want is some Californians saying, oh, what's the Supreme Court thing? Maybe I shouldn't sign up. You know, that is a bad personal decision and a bad decision for a community, because coverage means you're more apt to stay healthy, more apt to get tested, more apt to get care. That's what we want to have happen right now.
So, Peter, open enrollment is in effect right now. I believe it started November 1st. And you're saying that if you sign up right now, regardless of what happens with the Supreme Court today and when the ruling is made, that coverage will continue through all of next calendar year.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The reason I say that with such certainty is even the Trump administration, in their arguments before the Supreme Court, have said, throw out the law, but don't do it overnight. Don't allow people to transition, have change. So there's no one in the world saying, let's pull the rug out from 25 million Americans on June 17th when the Supreme Court rules. It's, you know, that would just not happen. And talk about having undercutting the legitimacy of a Supreme Court. To have a Supreme Court that would throw tens of millions off insurance in the middle of a pandemic, because I hate to tell everyone this, I think you all know it, no matter what happens with vaccines, next June, there's still going to be COVID around. We're going to be rolling this out over time. We will still be in a pandemic that we'll be dealing with in 6 months.
Peter, we only have a few minutes left, and at issue before the Supreme Court right now is the U.S. mandate. I know that Sammy has a follow-up question that's more California-based on that.
Yeah, Peter, I just wanted to ask about California's individual mandate since it is in place. And for those who may have forgotten how much insurance coverage you have in 2020, how long you go without coverage affects what penalty you may pay in 2021. Peter, I know a lot of people have lost their job-based coverage during the pandemic. Are there going to be exceptions for those people when applying the individual mandate in California?
A really good question. And I want to just, you know, it's interesting. Of all the parts of the Affordable Care Act, the individual mandate was the least popular. But I want to remind you, 40 years ago, a seatbelt requirement was unpopular. Wearing a seatbelt, we all do. We're used to it now. The rationale behind the individual mandate, it's a nudge for everyone to get covered. And it benefits everybody. Last year, our premiums went up 0.8%. This year, they're going up 0.5%. Why? In part, the individual mandate encouraged more people to get coverage. But let's be clear on how it works. Whatever the Supreme Court does, it's a state law that is on the books. If you can afford insurance coverage and choose not to get it, you'll be subject to pay a penalty when you file your state taxes with the Franchise Tax Board. Now, that's a big question. What does afford mean? If you make below a certain amount of income, you are not subject to a penalty. So if you're eligible for Medi-Cal and you make the stupid decision to not sign up for free coverage, you would be exempt from the penalty anyway. So the whole issue here is you are only subject to a penalty in California under state law if there's one, you're above a certain level of income, and number two, the health insurance available to you is, I put in air quotes, affordable. And again, this is, no one wants to play gotcha. I mean, we enrolled 350,000 people during the pandemic because we got the word out that if you lost your job because of the pandemic, come to Covered California. And that's one of the things we're doing right now, because we're promoting the connection between COVID and insurance coverage.
So if you lost your job as a result of the pandemic, the mandate in California would not hit you financially.
Probably not hit you if you lost your job. It depends on what your income was and what you have available for your options. Because again, if you lost your job and you then got a new job and you're making 100 grand and you decide to go without insurance, when you file your taxes, Franchise Tax Board would say, wait a minute, you made 100 grand, you chose to be uninsured, you're going to pay a penalty for those 6 months you're uninsured. So Randy, it depends on your circumstance, but generally the rule is if you're low income, no penalty. And if insurance costs too much, no penalty. But the main thing is, I want to write, forget the penalty. The real penalty is you get COVID, you end up in a hospital, you'd walk out with a $60,000 bill. That's a penalty. And that's what people should be thinking about, not the few hundred dollars the franchise tax board would ding you with when you file your taxes.
Peter, we have less than a minute left. So two things. One, when does the open enrollment end? And two, when do we expect a ruling from the Supreme Court?
I'll do those backwards. Supreme Court ruling in about 6 to 8 months, likely in June plus minus. So long time away. What's right around the corner, though, is our open enrollment period, which ends January 31st. But more importantly, people want to sign up by December 15th to make sure coverage is live January 1st. No one should be going a day without coverage now. And actually, if you're uninsured today, but you just lost your job a week ago, you could get coverage that starts December 1st. So, and that'd be 1 month of coverage, and you have a new plan starting January 1. So look, we're about helping people in the moment. And that's where people should be living when it comes to healthcare coverage.
All right. Peter Lee, Executive Director of Covered California. Appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for being on Insight. And
thanks,
Sammy Caola, it's great to have a co-host. Thank you for your insightful healthcare questions to Peter there. Appreciate Cap Radio's healthcare reporter joining me this morning. Thank you, Sammy.
Thanks, Randy.
Up next, we speak with Cap Radio's general manager about what the station is doing to address diversity, equity, and inclusion on this day, which is Public Media for All Day. And a bit later, we speak with an LA Times columnist about the historic significance of Kamala Harris becoming the next vice president of the United States. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. And this morning, we want to bring attention to a movement that's happening within public media. And that includes stations like this one, Cap Radio. Today is the launch of Public Media for All Day, a platform to bring attention to issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion, which play out in newsrooms and station management throughout the nation. It's not just who's hired, but who's promoted, what stories are covered, and the lens through which those stories are seen. We spoke yesterday with two people who helped found Public Media for All Day, including Ernesto Aguilar with the National Federation of Community Broadcasters and Sachi Kobayashi with Oregon Public Broadcasting. I began by asking Ernesto what inspired them to create this movement.
Public Media for All really came about from, I think, two tendencies that we were seeing. First and foremost, public media has faced a number of challenges, well-publicized scandals at organizations like WNYC, WAMU, WBEZ, and elsewhere that have reflected a cultural change that organizations are being forced to make by the fact that racial equity has become a mainstream conversation that I don't think the public media was really ready to contend with this year. You would think that that wouldn't be the case considering all that the country's experienced in 2020. However, public media has been slow to respond to the issues that many workers at these organizations have raised. Issues of staff being ignored, of harassment, of abuse by those in power, and of official unawareness of those issues, or just simply ignoring the fact that these issues were being brought to human resources offices. The second issue is the fact that, similar to the point that I made a moment ago, racial equity has become a mainstream conversation in the United States. Major commercial enterprises have gotten into the conversation around racial justice, and more of the public, listeners, viewers, and audiences online of public media and of all media organizations expect better of all of our organizations and expect us to do better in not just who represents us on the air, but also in recruitment, retention of board governance, and everywhere else in an organization. Really, there's a need for greater assessment of these organizations and how we as media can do better, because our audiences now expect it.
Mm-hmm. Saatchi, let's talk a little bit about the actual day. What actions are you hoping to see from people and from stations throughout the day today?
Yeah, so this is really, we're thinking of this more of an inauguration event than sort of a culmination. This is just the beginning. And we had originally thought of this day as a day for people of color who work in public media to call out sick and tired of the overwhelming whiteness. But it's actually really evolved, I think, in a beautiful way to be even more inclusive, which is wonderful because that's one of the things we're working on. And we now have a lot of ways for different people to participate. So, you know, in addition to the fact that we're hoping to provide support and community to people of color in this space, we're hoping to provide resources and inspire action communally for white allies. And we've also asked public media organizations to pledge to doing 10 of 11 DEI action items that are listed on our website. We've gotten several to sign up already. We hope to be talking about that more today in our webinar that we have later today. And we are also hoping that that inspires ongoing conversations that inspire even more public media organizations to commit to these DEI action items.
Well, Saatchi, I want to dig in a little more to the makeup of the people that work at public broadcasting stations. What about those who feel like perhaps they're a token person of color on their team or in the workplace?
Yeah, that's actually, so prior to us founding Public Media for All, some of the people on the organizing committee for Public Media for All were working on creating community in this space. So I started a Facebook group for people of color in public media more than a year ago to help those people who do maybe feel tokenized and alone connect with other people of public media and public in at other stations. And there's also a Slack channel that was started by Consuela Stewart, who has been working with us. And I think that's, you know, that is sort of the essence of the issue. A lot of stations are really small. There are definitely stations that only have one person of color. And so for those people, that's why we're building those communities.
Mm-hmm. Ernesto, one of the goals is also to give tools to white supporters of this movement. Talk a little bit about that.
As with any conversation, I think when anyone calls out an issue or brings to light an issue that could be perceived as a challenge to the status quo, everyone instinctually almost brings up, well, what do we do? Or what can we do? That's an important topic, but ... The points that Saatchi brings up are an effort by Public Media for All to help allies and organizations to find something actionable, to hold conversations in their organizations, to reach out to other organizations in their cities to support and to be more engaged, to do more to represent not just the voices in your organization, but how does your organization represent your community? And to do a little bit more of that and focus less on what the large issue may be, which is an important issue clearly, but try to break that larger issue down into actionable steps everyone can do to play a role. I think I speak for myself and certainly several of the other organizers that we believe that this culture is changing. We do believe that the country's culture is changing and more white allies want to be engaged in these conversations. But oftentimes they, like people of color, may feel disempowered. They're not exactly sure how they can participate and be good allies in this movement to change nonprofits and to change society. And so our effort is to try to ensure that those individuals have the resources, and all individuals have resources, to be better supporters and also to talk about and engage with their organizations a little bit more to move the needle in the direction of a more just public media.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, if I can piggyback off of that, I think there's a handful of stations and organizations within public media who have been leading the way. They're already doing a lot of this work. Unfortunately, there's a handful of stations and organizations that are probably never going to do this work. But we truly believe that the majority of stations and organizations want to do this, but maybe they haven't known where to begin. They haven't had the resources to get started. And they've maybe been thinking of it as a nice to have, not a have to have, and it keeps on getting put on the back burner. Mm-hmm. So this movement is really to give people the tools that they need to move this forward, make it a priority, and stick to it. Because frankly, as Ernesto said, like, the conversations in our country are changing around this, and that's not an accident, and that's not just because of a few specific high-profile news incidences. That is because the country is becoming majority-minority. This country will be majority-minority in the next couple decades, and there's no way for public media to serve everyone in this country effectively unless we start to address that and create more diverse programming, have institutions that reflect the people we serve, and that's going to be essential for the industry moving forward. So the case I'd like to make is this is not a nice to have, this is a have to have for the future of public media.
Yeah, and Saatchi, I imagine a disproportionate number of white people sit in positions of power at these stations. So if DEI, or diversity, equity, and inclusion, is going to be successful, it has to be made at those levels.
Correct. Yes, definitely. Yeah. I think there was a Columbia Journalism Review article that just came out yesterday that stated that only 23% of people at public media organizations were people of color. So when only 23% of the people who work at public media are people of color and the country is majority minority, how can we possibly do a good job of serving them?
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that it's at only 23% when it comes to public media stations?
Well, I think, this is something that people have been working on since the beginning of public media, and especially since the founding of the 1967 Broadcasting Act that founded the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. It's in the language of the act, it's in the charter of the CPB, that we're supposed to be serving underserved communities. And so people have been working on this for over 50 years. And I'm not sure I fully understand why we haven't made more progress. If I did, I might have a different job. but I do think if there was a moment to try to move this forward substantially, now is that moment. And I hope that we start to think of this less as something that is strategic, as I said before, and more as something that is deeply foundational to who we are as people in public media, as individuals, and also the identity of our organizations. Mm. And as we do that sort of soul-searching work, I think that might make it harder to have these kinds of conversations, because the fact is, this isn't rocket science. There are other industries and other areas. There are some nonprofits, even within public media, that have managed to become very diverse. Although it's not rocket scientist, it does require courageous conversations. And that requires having an open mindset, an abundant mindset, that gives people the sort of resilience and fortitude that they need to have these courageous conversations. So yeah, we're hoping to provide people with those resources.
So I would add to what Saatchi said, that there is a bit of a crisis of imagination in public media to some respect. As she points out, a lot of commercial for-profit enterprises have thought about diversity, equity, and inclusion, thought about recruitment, thought about retention, and are treating those as priorities. And public media, because it's been so focused on so many other issues over the years, hasn't given the attention that it needs to really recruit and retain and involve new board members, new journalists, new staffers, new managers, and the people who you think would better represent the organization. As well, I think at times there is a strange hesitancy in public media when it comes to talking about race. We can talk about the president and what he says. We can talk about abortion. We can talk about LGBTQIA rights. We can talk about all kinds of issues. But when you talk about race, suddenly it is treated as political and controversial. So if we don't start to get a little bit more warm with the idea that race is something that the country now understands is a mainstream discussion, and it's something that impacts so many homes all over the nation, and we as programming, we as membership development and other aspects of a public media organization need to understand the diversity of people's lives and perspectives and try to incorporate that a little bit more, I think we'll see a bit more change around how we recruit and how we involve and also how we grow our donor bases and our listenership.
Ernesto, you brought up something that I want to ask you about, and that is, how does the LGBTQ plus community fit into the diversity, equity, and inclusion goals of public media for All Day? Because I would imagine that there are members of the LGBTQ plus community that feel left out of the conversation and aren't represented in the positions of power, possibly to the same degree as people of color. But I don't see it represented on the website.
It is very, very good to see that the LGBTQIA community has been so active in public media. There are now journalism associations. There are fantastic leaders like Lewis Wallace and others who are really trying to lift up this voice quite a bit, and they have engaged with us as allies in this movement. Our focus has been on a particular area of diversity to some degree, but make no mistake that we certainly understand and embrace the fact that there is a larger movement afoot across the country to see that the wide variety of cultures, of ideas, of everything within all of us be represented more in public media, and that we start to embrace that in leadership, in content, and in recruitment and retention.
And that's Ernesto Aguilar with the National Federation of Community Broadcasters and Sachi Kobayashi with Oregon Public Broadcasting. Again, we spoke yesterday with the two founders of Public Media for All Day. Now let's bring that concept home. How is everything that Ernesto and Sachi just spoke about playing out at CAP Radio? To help answer those questions, we bring in June Reyna. He's CAP Radio's general manager and my boss, but I've been told that no questions related to this topic are off limits. So let's get to it. And first of all, nice to see you, June, even if it's over Zoom.
Yeah, good to see you, Randall.
For conversational purposes, I do want to point out that if you hear June or me using the initialism DEI, know that it stands for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. June, you signed up CAP Radio to take part in Public Media for All Day. How did you become familiar with it, and why did you feel it was a good fit for the station?
Well, I think being familiar with it was, it just came about organically. It was something that a lot of the staff had been talking about. I do want to echo what Sachi and Ernesto were talking about, that, you know, public media has, I think for the longest time, always struggled with diversity. So I've been in the industry 14 years, 13 years, and for as long as I can remember, diversity has always been a strategic goal in some shape or form, you know, whether it's expanding staff, it's expanding audience or our board composition. But in the past, we've always been willing to accept it as, just the way it is, you know, that the well isn't deep enough, that there aren't enough diverse candidates that apply for positions. And so it's almost become a self-fulfilling prophecy for us. But I think this year is very different. I think there's been some sort of a reckoning this year, and we're no longer willing to concede that the well isn't deep enough.
Yeah. Walk us through, June, if you can, what CAP Radio will do differently today, and I guess moving forward, right, as part of this movement.
Well, you know, several meetings, I've said to our managers that we can't expect diversity to just walk in the door. It's something that we need to be proactive about, and it's something that we need to build, right? So, and you know, to that end, you know, Cap Radio's evolved its hiring practices. We're trying to be much more inclusive in the way we hire new candidates. The board itself is much more receptive to the idea of diversity and equity. And we've brought on a professional coach, you know, to help the station through a lot of the DEI issues.
Describe what the board does. What I work here and I'm not even 100% sure. Yeah. What is the board? The board of directors? Yeah.
So yes, the board of directors. So we had our board retreat a couple months ago. And for the first time, the board, you know, proactively tackled issues around diversity. In fact, they went through implicit bias training. That's never happened before. And so there is a commitment on the part of the board to really tackle these issues from a foundational standpoint. And Saatchi referred to it earlier, that this is more than just a strategic issue, right? This needs to be foundational. This needs to be ingrained in the organization's DNA. And so, you know, going back to the staff, and I know you'll have Sarah on the air a little later, but we've formed a station affinity group for people of color. It's a place for them to feel safe and a place for healing and to feel empowered. But on the flip side of that is we're also in the process of forming a white caucus. So it's a place for white staff to be able to engage in these types of conversations. So it's all about, I guess it's all about building spaces where people feel safe to discuss issues like this.
Mm. And I do, I'll take this opportunity since you brought it up to bring in Sarah Mises-Tan. She's our race and equity reporter. Sarah, great to have you here. As
great
always,
to be here.
you're such a friend of Insight. Sarah, you belonged to a group like this in Boston when you were working back in Massachusetts, right? Is that what you modeled the Cap Radio version after?
Yeah. You know, I think talking a little bit about like why I decided to create an affinity group at Cap Radio requires me to explain a little bit about my own background. I did used to work as a reporter at a kind of remote bureau station for a station in Massachusetts. And I was, as was mentioned earlier, I was the only person of color at that very small station. And I think I was the first person of color to ever have worked there. Mm. And so it was a pretty isolating experience, I would say, overall. There are a lot of things that happened to me that really shaped the way that I viewed race and racism and how journalism should address that. But I think that's a question later on. But for now, you know, I would say it was an extremely isolating experience. But the station did form, the larger station up in Boston did form an affinity group during my time there. And I found it to be a very supportive space. I would actually make it a priority to attend because I just found it so comforting to even have a group of people of color that I could speak with candidly about any issues that I was facing or questions that I had just around, you know, how station management was addressing diversity or, you know, is everyone else running up against this? Is this just a me problem?
Yeah. And you're hearing that from people here at the station, too, that have become part of the affinity group?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think that it was really helpful to just have a safe space where people of color could speak with other people of color and compare notes, because otherwise I do feel that there are so few of us and we are so isolated, even if there is a person of color who sits next to us, you know, at the station. I think that like with COVID that happened with Cap Radio, like I again felt very isolated and it was nice to just be able to connect with other people of color in a formal way. You know, we meet every other week, every other Friday morning, and to just check in with everyone and say, mm-hmm. okay, like, hey, how's everybody feeling? Did anyone experience anything that you had questions about? Or maybe something happened to you and you have an idea about how maybe Cap Radio can better address it.
Do you talk about coverage at all? Like what stories were chosen, how the story was told, content issues, do those come up?
No, we don't really. This is really just emotional support. And mm-hmm. just we talk really about how Cap Radio can become a better and more inclusive space for its current BIPOC employees.
June, you are a person of color and your job at Cap Radio is as high up the ladder as one can possibly climb at this station. But the management team as a whole at Cap Radio is disproportionately white and male, and as far as I know, entirely straight. So diversity is lacking on the leadership level. How does Cap Radio plan to address that?
So, yeah, that's true. One of the things I remember most about when I first got hired at Cap Radio was when I walked in the door, the person that met me was a person of color. So this was, you know, Carl Watanabe, who used to be our station manager. Right. He's retired. He retired several years ago. But that in and of itself, it created a warm and fuzzy feeling for me that I felt like, you know, there was somebody at the station who looked like me. And so I think, you know, when we talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion, if we get the equity and inclusion parts right, then diversity would follow. You know, if you look at how it's been over the years, you know, when I got to Cap Radio, we were 45 employees. We're now 107. So, you know, as much as I think that DEI issues or DEI priorities need to be properly resourced, this is not a resource issue. If we've been able to grow at that rate, but not diversify the staff, then there's something foundationally wrong, right? And so you can't necessarily fix the problem by just hiring more people of color, right? You need to be able to fix it at its most foundational aspects or organizational aspects. And that's why we want to get the board involved. That's why I'm not interested in making token statements about, you know, how we are not a racist organization or anything like that. I think the value of this work is the work itself, you know, getting the job done at its very, at its most foundational and structural level.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a conversation that we could bring back on a regular basis on Insight, mm-hmm. but I'm glad we had it today. Cap Radio's general manager, June Reyna, and Cap Radio's race and equity reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan, talking about public media for all day. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Randall.
And still ahead, we consider the historic significance of Kamala Harris as vice president with thoughts from LA Times columnist Erica Smith. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. A vice president-elect Kamala Harris has broken many glass ceilings throughout her career. She was California's first black attorney general. She was the second black woman to be elected to the United States Senate. And now Kamala Harris has made history as the first woman, the first Asian American, and the first black American to be elected vice president. Her mother was an immigrant from India. Her father from Jamaica. Erica Smith is a columnist with the Los Angeles Times, and she recently wrote about why Kamala Harris could become an unapologetically black vice president. Erica joins us now, and welcome to Insight. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a landmark moment for the United States. What first went through your mind when you knew Kamala Harris was about to become vice president-elect?
Well, I think, you know, she was never, to be fair, she was never my first choice back when we were during the campaign. I was actually an Elizabeth Warren supporter. But, you know, I think after she was named by Joe Biden and after, you know, some of the campaign, some of the backlash from the Trump administration, I really did become more of her fan. And I think that seeing her the other night on stage in that white suit and kind of embodying all of the various different dreams and hopes, I think, of a lot of women in this country. It was just kind of amazing, particularly after the last 4 years of listening to the racist rhetoric out of the Trump administration and this same with sexist rhetoric. And so to see her there kind of not only just saying, you know, I am now your vice president elect, but also kind of reflecting on the fact that how she got there and the many women that have gone through public office and have helped her get to that point. So that was just an amazing feeling to see somebody up there that actually looked like me.
Right. And what does that moment and Harris as VP elect mean for girls of color, particularly Black Americans and Asian American girls?
I mean, I think it means a lot. I mean, I think growing up being 4, 5, 6 years old and knowing your first, you know, vice president you remember that you see is a Black woman or somebody who looks like you, that opens up a whole lot of doors. I mean, I'm 43 and my first real president that I remember was the first Bush. And so my memories and my thinking about life is very different than, say, somebody who was a kid when Obama was president and who had a totally different perspective on what power in this country could look like. And so you see that today in the electorate and how people talk about politics and what's possible. And so the idea for young Black or young girls of color to be able to see somebody who looks like them at some of the top, you know, areas of power in this country, it means a lot. It means that you can go forward and you can do pretty much anything you want to do, which is something that a lot of women didn't grow up with in this country.
One of the aspects of your columns, and it's right there in the title, that I found interesting is that you wrote, when Kamala Harris takes the oath of office in January, expect it to be unapologetically Black. Tell us a little bit about what you meant there.
Well, I think some of it goes back to kind of what I was saying about the last 4 years and the public opinion and pressure that has come about and some of the rhetoric that's happened that's been pretty racist. And also just what's happened in the past year with the death of George Floyd and various other police killings leading up to that point where seeing Senator Harris now becoming the vice president, I mean, I think there's just kind of this unabashed joy that's going to come with it, that people are going to be like, finally, after all of this, you know, racist stuff over the last 4 years or so, or even longer, that we are finally getting somebody of color into office. And so I think that just, I mean, again, assuming COVID will let us have an actual inauguration of something that we actually are used to seeing, I do think you're going to have a lot of people of color, particularly a lot of Black women that are going to be out there. Obviously, Kamala went to Howard University, which is a historically Black university. So you're going to see a number of folks from those colleges and universities that are going to be out there celebrating. She's a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha, which is one of the historically Black sororities. And so you're going to see a number of women out there in pink and green, which is that sorority's kind of signature colors. And so, I mean, I think that, you know, and again, this is different than 2008, right? I mean, this is not, a lot has happened in the last 12 years. And I think that people are more used to seeing African-Americans and people of color be more of their full selves in public. And I think that what you're going to see on that inauguration day is going to reflect that.
And you compare a difference between former President Obama, who was the very first person of color on a White House ticket, and his behavior on Inauguration Day and moving forward. You see a difference between how Harris may act compared to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, again, there's a difference between 2020 and 2008. And just, you know, being the first of a person of color on the national scene in that way, I mean, he walked into a whole lot of expectations about what it is it does and does not mean to be Black in this country. Just the campaign that he ran, you kind of saw that. And I think that he was used to having to fit into a box. And I think that near the end of his term, you got to see the person that, you know, we more readily see today. I mean, it wasn't even a month ago that, you know, originally somebody pointed out to me back in 2008, it was an issue that he played basketball. And now, like, you know, he's sinking three pointers and dress slacks, you know, a week ago on Twitter and gloating about it. And so I think that, you know,
he says, Kamala, that's what I do.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I do, which was very good. But I think that I think Kamala Harris is going to benefit from that, from the sacrifices that he made in the public eye and what he carved. And I also think she's also going to benefit from the many women that came before her. I mean, even Hillary Clinton, just, you know, the various different sexist things that she had to deal with over time. I think that Kamala Harris is going to benefit from the people who have gone before. And I think she's well aware of that, which is nice to see.
We don't have a lot of time left, but a vice president's role can vary greatly depending on the administration. In a Biden-Harris administration, do you believe that Harris will take up one or two key issues as vice president?
I think she probably will. I mean, the pressure is certainly going to be on for her to do so. I think criminal justice reform and police reform are going to be two of the things that she's going to get an enormous amount of pressure to do. And I think that if she doesn't deliver on that front, I think that a lot of people are going to kind of back off of her support for her. But I do think she'll do that. And I do think that she will probably take up a few more issues. And I think her voice will be very instrumental in this administration.
Erica Smith is columnist with the Los Angeles Times. Her recent column is Why Kamala Harris Could Become an Unapologetically Black Vice President. Thank you so much for joining us today on Insight, Erica.
Thank you.
And you can find out more about any of the guests you heard from today here on Insight at capradio.org/insight. And that is the show for today. Producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon helped get everyone in place. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minotta. Technical director is Mark Jones. Engineer is Antonio Munez. Insight's managing editor is Aram Sarkissian, and Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And don't forget, today is Public Media for All Day, and Cap Radio is taking part. I'm Randall White. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.